Our podcast reviews well-known movies and contains spoilers. The podcast may contain mature subject matter and mature language. Listener discretion is advised. Enjoy the show.
Quiet on set. Places, everybody. And action.
It's time once again for the Hooked on Movies podcast. Today's movie is the 1994 prison drama, The Shawshank Redemption. With me are Ken.
Yeah, the funny thing is, on the outside, I was an honest man. Straight as an arrow. I had to come to this podcast to be a crook.
And Ted.
Gotta get busy living or get busy dying.
And I'm Eric. Hope is a good thing. Maybe the best of things. And no good thing ever dies, in theory, of course. All right, we're talking Shawshank Redemption. Ken, tell us about the synopsis.
All right, Andy Dufresne is sentenced to two consecutive life terms in prison for the murders of his wife and her golf pro lover. However, only Annie knows he didn't commit the crimes. While there, he forms a friendship with Red, experiences brutality of prison life, adapts, and then helps the warden all in a span of 19 years.
That's right. It does go over 19 years, doesn't it? That's crazy. All right. Ted, particulars, what do you got?
Okay. Shawshank Redemption is directed by Frank Darabont with a screenplay by Frank Darabont. It's based off of the novella Rita Hayworth and the Shawshank Redemption by Stephen King. It has a running time of 142 minutes. It's a release date of September 23rd, 1994. A budget of $25 million. It had a box office gross of $73 million. On Rotten Tomatoes, it has a critic score of a certified fresh 89% and an audience score of a robust 98%. And something to add, on IMDb, their rating system, Shawshank Redemption is the number one movie.
Like of every format, it is the number one movie of all time?
By voted on by people from
it's impressive
the viewers on IMDb, yep.
Except for Smokey and the Bandit 3. I think that's right, a little bit
exactly.
Higher.
Ooh,
ouch! Yeah, right. Ouch. Shawshank Redemption stars Tim Robbins as Andy Dufresne, Morgan Freeman as Ellis Boyd Red Redding, Bob Gunton as Warden Samuel Norton, William Sadler as Haywood, Clancy Brown as Corrections Officer Byron Hadley, Gil Bellows as Tommy Williams, and James Whitmore as Brooks Hatlin.
Cool. All right, Ken, tell us about some of the production notes on this movie.
Darabont, he bought the rights to the book from Stephen King for $5,000.
Wow, which, that's a steal.
That is a steal, but Stephen King didn't even bother to cash the check. In fact, he had it framed and sent it back to him, basically saying, if you ever need money, break glass. So that's pretty funny. And then Rob Reiner tried to buy the screenplay in hopes to direct it, but Darabont said no. Darabont took a pay cut in order for him to direct this, because this is his first time directing a movie.
It's a pretty nice movie to start out with.
No doubt. Stephen King really enjoyed his take on his book, and that's why he went ahead and sold it to him for only $5,000. As far as the two main leads for the part, for the role of Andy, Tom Cruise was considered and actually sat on some table reads, but he decided that he didn't want to work with a first-time director. Tom Hanks and Kevin Costner were both offered it, but Hanks was filming Forrest Gump and Costner was filming Waterworld. One made the right choice, probably, and the other one probably didn't.
Didn't he direct Waterworld too? Wasn't that like his baby, pretty much?
Yeah, that was his baby. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an okay movie. I've seen it. It's all right.
It's marginal at best.
And Charlie Sheen, he begged, I mean, literally begged to be in this movie. He wanted the part of Andy so bad, but he didn't get it. Well, the reason why Robbins got it was because the director loved him in this performance of Jacob's Ladder, which I saw.
Yes, he was very good in Jacob's Ladder.
I saw that in the theater, the Trivoli, and I think that's technically in Downers Grove, maybe?
It's in Downers.
Only time I saw a movie there. Red was initially offered to Gene Hackman and Robert Duvall, but they were both unavailable. the Red character itself is actually an Irishman, so that makes sense that those two would be offered the part. But the producer really loved Morgan Freeman for this and didn't care about what the character was in the book. And so Morgan Freeman got the part. And then this movie ended up getting nominated for 7 Academy Awards and won none of them. It was nominated for Best Picture, Best Actor for Freeman, Best Screenplay for Darabont, Best Cinematography, Best Sound, Film Editing, and Best Original Score. Highly regarded, but it bombed at the box office, as Ted gave us the numbers on that.
It didn't surpass the budget until award season came, and that's when it made an additional money that made it profitable.
So here's a list of who was nominated. I mean, this is a who's who of movies back in 1994, 1995. Forrest Gump won. Mm-hmm. Four Weddings and a Funeral was nominated. Pulp Fiction was nominated. Quiz Show. And, of course, The Shawshank Redemption. So that was a pretty solid line of movies there. In my opinion, Shawshank should have been one. Pulp Fiction probably two. And Forrest Gump, maybe three, though I love Four Weddings and a Funeral.
No. Forrest Gump all the way. Come on.
No. Shawshank is a better movie than this.
No.
But we'll talk about that later. Not.
Yeah.
And that's what I have for production and awards. There's more to talk about, but we'll save that for later in the podcast.
All right, let's talk about the first time we saw this movie. Ken, when's the first time you saw this movie?
I saw this movie actually in the theater when the Academy Awards roughly came out, because it was doing well and got another chance to make some money. So I was part of that group that Ted was mentioning earlier about it didn't make money until Oscar season. I went to go see it in the theater from all the buzz it was getting.
For me, I saw this thing on DVD, obviously years after. I didn't see it probably until late 2000s, kind of just went under my radar, and I didn't see it during the time of its height. What about you, Ted?
It was probably on TNT because it played on regular cable, man. Like every
you
week.
You saw this for the first time edited. That is a crime, huge crime.
TNT
not that bad
didn't,
on TNT.
TNT didn't it,
it
edit
doesn't,
it.
It's irrelevant. Even if one word is removed from this movie because it's playing on cable, you can't see it for the first time on TBS or TNT or one of these loser cable sites that don't have the balls to show it first run with all of its language or nudity or violence or whatever. You can't see the movie for the first time there.
There really isn't any language in this movie.
It's irrelevant. You still had commercials.
It's those commercials, yeah.
It's irrelevant. It's criminal.
Well, Andy, we are watching a prison movie.
It's criminal. That's right. Should go to jail for that, Ted.
All right. I'll be like Andy. That's fine.
Butt fucked in the
library. Wow. That's a totally different Shawshank Redemption.
That's something right there.
So much for our
you're the one that wants friendly. To be Andy, I'm just saying. So
much for our family-friendly version here. So let's roll into part one of this one, Ken.
In early 1947, banker Andy Dufresne arrives at Shawshank State Prison to serve two consecutive life sentences for murdering his wife and her lover. He's befriended by Red, a contraband smuggler, serving a life sentence, we think, for murder, who procures a rock hammer and a large poster of Rita Hayworth for Andy. Assigned to work in the prison laundry, Andy is frequently raped by prison gang, along with Ted, the sisters, and their leader, Boggs. In 1949, Andy overhears the captain of the guards complaining about being taxed on his inheritance and offers to help him shelter the money legally. After an assault by the sisters nearly kills Andy, Hallie beats and cripples Boggs, who then is transferred to another prison. Andy is not attacked again. Warden Samuel Norton meets Andy and reassigns him to the prison library. A front is used to use Andy's financial expertise to manage financial matters for other prison staff, guards from other prisons, and the warden himself. Andy begins writing weekly letters to the state legislature requesting funds to improve the library. Brooks is paroled in 1954 after serving 50 years, but he cannot adjust to the outside world and eventually hangs himself. The legislature sends a library donation that includes a recording of the marriage of Figaro. Annie plays part of the record over the public address system and is punished with solitary confinement. After his release from solitary, Andy explains to a dismissive Red that hope is what gets him through his sentence. In 1963, Norton begins exploiting the prison labor for public works, profiting by undercutting skilled labor costs and receiving bribes. Andy launders the money using the alias Randall Stevens. And that's the end of part one.
So where do we want to start with this one?
Start at the beginning.
Start at the beginning.
Andy Dufresne. I love how this movie starts. I love it comes from a black screen and you hear the music playing over the radio and you get your first picture of Andy. Andy is a quintessential Stephen King character.
Right.
He's desperate. He's down on his luck. He knows that his wife is fooling around on him. She wants a divorce and he's at his wit's end. I love the fact that it's kind of ambiguous. You think you know what happens, but you're not exactly sure. And then it cuts into the court where Andy's defending himself on the stand against the DA. When the DA lays out his case, you know that there's really no hope for Andy at that point.
No, he's railroaded, of course.
Yeah. What do you expect? There's bullets, you know, on the ground, along with a broken bottle of whiskey. He's drinking.
Right. Yeah.
That it does put him there.
Oh, and yeah. He even no, admits he's definitely
even
there.
Being there.
He puts himself at the scene of the crime. Yeah, he's drinking cheap whiskey. It's rot gut, essentially. He readily admits that he was out of his mind and didn't know what to do. You know, we went over who stars in this movie, but here again, in quintessential King fashion, the way the movie's shot, Shawshank is its own character, and the building itself, the way when they pull up in the bus, the overhead
yeah. shot from the they used the helicopter, that was
the prison is clearly the third main character in
it's sure. I mean, and the looking up as they're walking into the prison, you're looking up at the windows. It's a Gothic style inspired prison. It's actually the Mansfield, Ohio prison for reformatory that's still standing now. It's actually a haunted location.
The actors actually say that they felt that was haunted when they were there.
No, it was shut down for its brutality back in the day.
It wasn't shut down very long, I don't think, before this movie, actually. I want to say 6 months.
Yeah, but it was in bad disrepair. They had to do a lot of repairs.
Most prisons are when they're about ready to shut them down. That's one of the reasons for shutting them down is just it's no longer, even for prisoners, it's just not a place. But I love what we're saying here about it being like a third wheel here to this movie. It's part of the cast. I mean, that overhead shot, and then when they're walking up to it for the first time, you get a sense of a different world. Like, mm-hmm. This is totally different from everywhere else in society. And some of the shots later that we see when they're in prison and they're looking outside of prison, like up on the roof when they're tarring, all you can see is green grass on the other side.
It's supposed to represent hope.
Right. Yeah. The grass is greener on the other side type of deal.
Exactly.
And there's a lot of cliches in this movie, but they're nice and subtle. When you watch it enough times, you start saying, oh, I get what you did there. So this is that kind of movie. There's a charm to that prison, and I'm not saying it's a good charm. It just plays off, as Red says, at first you don't like being there, but then you get used to it, and then eventually you depend on those walls.
That's the prisoners, how the human mind adapts to its surroundings. You become institutionalized. Back to the building itself, it's very reminiscent of the Overlook from The Shining. It's its own character.
Well, it's funny that you said that, because Red Cell, what number is his cell number?
237, yeah.
You caught that. Nice job.
Of course.
Room 237, cell 237.
It's very ominous, and it's funny because you know the first time you're introduced to the warden, you know the warden is, he's a different type of a person. It's a debate as to who's more evil, Hadley or the warden.
The warden, because the warden plays off it being that he's this Christian, right. Bible reading, you know, kind of guy.
Exactly.
Whereas Hedley is just a thug. And that's how the actor decided to play it. He didn't want to play it like a straight prison guard. He wanted to give him no redeeming qualities whatsoever. I think the closest redeeming quality he gets is when he brings the beer up and tells them to drink up. And then Red says, you know, that he actually sounded kind of human by doing that. So, but outside that, I mean, he beats the crap out of anybody. It doesn't matter if they're good, bad, or ugly. He doesn't care. The warden says, take care of it, he takes care of it. I mean, he's about ready to throw Andy off a roof. People see him kill an inmate right there in front of everybody for basically crying, you know, and not being able to shut up, and he beats him to death. I mean, no, man, nothing happens to him.
That's another King moment. You're walking into evil. Evil's all around. It's amazing how Red and his group of guys that are around him, and then Andy, and they can maintain a sense of humanity amongst themselves. But here again, it's funny because the whole story is told from Red's point of view. And that's what the actor who played Hadley said. He was trying to figure out how to play Hadley, and he was just like, this person has nothing to redeem him. And then it was explained to him, well, this is from Red's point of view. There would have been no redeeming qualities for Hadley. And he said that that was very freeing at that point, that he could just be as evil as he could possibly be. So,
Do we know if his character is any different?
No, he's evil in the book as well. There's a few things that are very different from the novella to the movie, one being the ending. The other, Brooks's character is really only a paragraph in the novella. The Shawshank Redemption, or Rita Hayworth and the Shawshank Redemption, is a series of four stories in Stephen King's titled book, The Different Seasons. It's The Body, which turned into Stand By Me, Apt Pupil, which also had a very not good movie made of it, and then Rita Hayworth and the Shawshank Redemption. The other story out of Different Seasons is connected to the Dark Tower series. They're amazing. I absolutely love Stephen King. There are some differences, some subtle differences, and some big differences. We'll talk about the end when we get to it. But in the novella, there's three wardens that go through while Andy's there. Each warden is a little bit different, and they kind of combine all three into Bob Gunton's portrayal of Warden Norton.
That makes kind of sense, because that there would be three wardens instead of one. I mean, you have a 19-year history here, 19 to 20 years, with the same warden. Like, Brooks talks about other wardens and about how they've never gotten funds for the library even before this warden came. So, and then I find it interesting that you have, like you were talking about, these group of prisoners that are this little niche that they get. I mean, they're able to get, Red is able to get all of them to do the tarring of the roof on top, because he knows how to manipulate the system. One of the problems I have right off the bat with this group, they never age. Nobody ages. Nobody ages. Two, nobody comes in and out of this group. Nobody gets paroled in those 19 years. Nobody new comes into their group. The only person is Brooks. I don't think he's really part of the group. He's kind of like the old timer that they respect, but he isn't hanging out with them throughout the whole film like all the other characters. I just thought it was interesting that all those characters had been there that long, and we really didn't know much about them as far as why they had such a long sentence. We know Red supposedly killed somebody at a young age, but we don't know the other people. So I just thought that was kind of weird that the same group of guys stayed together and nobody either left. It was like a mafia thing. Nobody came in and nobody came out of it.
The way that it's been described is that, because here again, this is from Red's point of view, whereas, because Red doesn't really age either. His hair never really changes.
Just gets a little grayer towards the end. That's about it.
So,
right.
Essentially what they're saying is, based off of Red's perspective, once you enter Shawshank, time stops, essentially, for you.
Makes sense.
Because it's a good analogy, actually, yeah.
Because Andy's the only one that noticeably ages.
I don't think he noticeably ages. He gets a little gray on the side, but
He
gets glasses, and he gets a little wrinkles, but then when he gets out, his wrinkles somehow go away.
Completely changes, exactly. Yeah. even though it's not necessarily in the novella, it's a King element. When you escape from the evil that is Shawshank, you return back to normal life. You've escaped that vortex kind of a thing. It's a very King-esque narrative element there, and I think that's why King really says that this is the best adaptation of his work. And you had mentioned in the production notes that he sold it for $5. That's King's normal type of a deal, where if a new director comes to him and asks for one of his short stories or novellas, he sells it for a bare bottom amount. And that's because of his experience with The Shining and Stanley Kubrick. He has to approve it, but he will give it. And when he gives it for an amount because he wants to give them an opportunity. He's very magnanimous in that sense.
So we get into this movie and we go into Andy starting to become friends with Red. And of course, I mentioned earlier that the original character was Irish. And then, in fact, there's that joke in there. And you know, why do they call you Red? Maybe because I'm Irish.
Right.
It's a funny little line. But I find it interesting that Andy asked for a rock hammer. I don't understand the purpose of the rock hammer. I understand that he likes to shape things, chess pieces and things of that nature. But does a rock hammer really help you with that? I don't know. The size of the rock hammer seemed to be a little too big for help shaping with rocks. But that's just my look at it.
Well, and he's digging around the yard to get the rocks, too. Andy also has also figured out exactly what the cell walls are made of as well. And he,
well,
knows
he doesn't know that until afterwards, because he's actually using that rock hammer.
He's carving his name in,
Right. Yeah. And then a little chunk comes out. How does he not hide that chunk, by the way?
He pulls the Great Escape plan from the movie The Great Escape. He pushes it through his pants legs.
No, I get all that. No, I'm talking about them coming into before he gets the poster, because it takes a while for them to get the poster.
He doesn't start doing the actual hole until he gets the Rita Hayworth poster.
Right, but he accidentally...
Oh, well,
takes
I mean,
a chunk out of the wall before gets the Rita Hayworth poster.
They wouldn't have. Those guys were not. Yeah. They were looking for stuff that was much different than that. I mean, all of those walls were crumbling, and Hadley had other things on his mind as far as just being an asshole. They were too busy worried about ruling with an iron fist.
I do agree with you as far as they did everything they could to make prison life seemed like the worst thing ever. You know, right off the bat, you get the one guy who gets killed by the guard right there. It kind of sets the tone that there's going to be some problems here. I mean, even when they're in line and that guy goes, "When do we eat?" Mm-hmm. The guard comes up and just gives him a nightstick into the gut. But it's not just more of that. It's also then the sister's taking a liking to him and him running for his. But to the point where, you know, he gets beat up because he defends himself and he says things to them to piss them off. I think that was the most uncomfortable of the movie is the sisters. That's an invasion of privacy in more than one way. To a certain extent, I wish the sisters didn't kind of totally disappear, because I wish there was kind of a threat like that throughout the whole movie. Just because I think that keeps it a little bit more, I guess you could say more realistic, but I guess because Andy was kind of protected by the guards by that point, he was helping the guards and helping the warden with, you know, taxes and then eventually with scams.
Yeah, money talks.
That's another subtle difference. I'm not going to go into all the differences, but how Andy pays Red, he actually pays the guards to protect him from Boggs in the novella. Andy, when he comes into prison, he brings $500 in his rectum, and he pays off the guards, and that's how he pays for the rock hammer and everything like that.
I was wondering where they got money from. This was a certain dollar amount, and I was like,
right.
Okay. I understand the cigarettes thing, but I didn't understand the dollar stuff.
Yeah, that's how they play it in the movie, is that you're paying, the currency is cigarettes. But yeah, in the novella, he smuggles $500 in his butt. But yeah,
so, so when he met up with the sisters, he already knew how that felt. So
wow.
I'm sure that felt a lot different. But sure it did. Red describes them perfectly as they are. They're inhuman. These are the worst of the worst. And even the warden knows. And see, and that's the thing. You realize throughout the movie how just truly evil the warden is. The warden even uses the sisters as kind of leverage against Andy when he's been tossed into the solitary for a month. The warden knows what's going on, and he allows it to happen. The warden is kind of like the puppet master of this whole thing. He's controlling everything. We talk about the rocks and everything, and Andy and Red talk about chess. The warden is kind of like the chess master. He's moving the pieces around the board and how he wants, but he meets his match. But yeah, no, the warden knows everything that's going on. And the sisters are, it's probably the warden, Hadley, and the sisters are probably the three, well, you could probably say Shawshank, the building itself too, are the really the four main protagonists of the movie. And the sisters are evil. But here again, Andy's smart enough to play one evil against the other. And he curries favor with the guards. And Hadley does him a favor and cripples Box.
Do we think that with Andy helping out, keeping the inheritance that he got from his brother, do you think that was all pre-planned? Because Red thinks it's just to feel human again. I think it's part of the plan.
Andy's playing the long game. Andy is the master chess player. And the warden thinks that he's playing everything. And it's so funny because, you know, there's a saying, he's playing chess and everybody else is playing checkers. And mm-hmm. Red and Andy always play checkers. Andy's really the one playing chess. And the warden thinks he's playing chess, but Andy's the one that's really playing chess. Andy has figured out over the course of, it's probably, I think it's 2 years, because that's how long the sisters had been on him. And Andy's figured out how to manipulate people around the board. And he knows that if he curries favor with Hadley and gets Hadley what he wants, not only is he going to get his friend's beer, but he's also going to get favor. And he knows that if Hadley thinks that Hadley's on his side or is going to move his attention elsewhere, then he can do what he wants. I mean, that's why they don't take down the picture. You talked about the hole, the initial hole. The right. Bigger issue is the hole that comes after behind the picture. Why didn't they take down the picture? This big picture on the wall. All of the other pictures are these, you see them all over the other inmates' walls. They're little bitty, like not even 8x10s. But then here's Andy that has this poster size thing. Why didn't they take it down?
I think they don't take it down because, well, first of all, they're sizing Andy up. I mean, the warden's sizing it up.
Of course.
He's trying to be friends with Andy. I mean, he's mm-hmm. at least pretending yeah. to be
he's
friends.
He's pretending, yes.
First of all, you got the Bible. You know, he's got the Bible in his hand. They're kind of bonding, and they're going back and forth with Bible verses, and their Bible verses going back and forth about each other.
You know, oh, yeah.
Andy, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So you're talking about chess moves and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. They're swinging back and forth at each other. Like there's an understanding, right?
Exactly.
But I love how Tim Robbins said how he plays Andy. He says, I always played Andy with, I had a secret to hide. Mm-hmm. And you could see that throughout the whole film that he has a look on his face that's always, when am I going to get caught? You know, mm-hmm. type of deal. And especially in that, when he walks away almost with his Bible. It's easier to see all this with repeated watches when he's standing there with his body turned to everybody else as they're going through everything. And you see the poster behind him and he just has this worried look like they may find something behind that poster. So I loved Tim Robbins's performance here. His range isn't high to low or anything. It's kind of a straight kind of just play, but it's facial expressions. It's his facial expressions throughout the whole movie. When he's happy about something, he has a little smirk. He doesn't have mm-hmm. a big, huge smile, and he's not laughing or anything like that. You know, when they tell him that the kid passes, you know, the test, he's got a little smirk. It's just the perfect way of playing it.
You never want to play poker with Andy Dufresne. The warden is literally, we know because we've seen the end of the movie, he's walking away with the rock hammer. The rock hammer is in that Bible, and Andy doesn't even flinch. Andy's an awesome character. I love Andy Dufresne. I think he's one of King's best characters. Not my favorite King character by any stretch of the imagination, but he's one of my more favorite King characters. I don't think Andy ever even, except to carve out the rock hammer, I think Andy knew all of those passages anyway from the Bible. I think Andy's kind of a genius. IQ and everything is above everybody else.
Well, he's a reader. We know he's amazing. He reads. Yeah. He's an educated man. We see it at the beginning, all the way through the movie, where he knows the author of books and knows what the books are about. They even say he's that smart young banker. This character has a education that maybe very few people have in that prison. Brooks might be the only one that might even read more than Andy because of where he's at, and that's the library.
I love the scene where he finds with the poster. I think it's one of my favorite scenes.
I am not surprised they kept it up there. I mean, could they have easily ripped it down when they came in?
Oh, very much so, yes.
Sure.
One of the things, if they're leaving it up there, you're setting the precedent for other inmates seeing this giant hole.
Well, that's true. If they did find it, you know, what does that say about...
Right. Now they know someone's broken out. At least if you leave the poster up there, you're still kind of masking the problem a little bit.
You know, the other thing about Andy, I mean, when he does get those books that come in, you know, he's very excited about that. It's a shame that Brooks isn't able to see all that. That's a very interesting character, because I think it might have been Ted that said this at the beginning. Brooks has only got in the book, I think, one paragraph about him.
That's crazy. Only one small paragraph, huh?
But Stephen King can do with one paragraph is what other people can't do for a whole book. But
true.
He's still a memorable character from the novella. But yeah, James Whitmore is amazing here. And just as an antidote, I showed the movie to my daughter. She liked Brooks's character, mainly because, you know, he raises the bird, Jake. She only got emotional like a couple of times in the movie, and she actually cried when he had to give up Jake. And then, of course, when Brooks kills himself, to me is one of the most heartbreaking scenes in the movie.
That he couldn't handle Brooks. The outside life.
Yeah.
Did you feel like he was killing himself at first when he's walking up there, but once he's like inscribing his name up there, did we really buy he was going to kill himself?
I did.
I figured.
But I didn't see any rope coming up with them, so they played it off that maybe he wasn't going to death.
Darabont does an amazing job keeping things close to the vest, so to speak. But yeah, unfortunately. What really sets it off for me is when he's doing the narration of the letter, and he's sitting on the park bench feeding the pigeons, and the look on his face. Yeah, he's friends with Red's group, but like you said, he wasn't really a part of Red's group other than he was kind of like Red's go-between to deliver his goods. Jake was his whole life, and he had to essentially give his best friend up. We say that that's just one part, but that was his tie to reality. You know what I mean? And not having that and being forced to give that up because he couldn't afford to keep him. It's very sad. In a movie full of hope, that's probably the lowest point. Your heart breaks for that character. And seeing that's one of the crazy things that is so amazing here. And that's storytelling that is not lost from book to screen or to screenplay, is that they take this place where there's no hope exists. And these are bad guys, okay? These are murderers and they're criminals. But the way their story's told, you get a sense of humanity from all of them, that they're real people. And there is something redeeming, and that's called the redemption.
Again, it comes to Red's perspective. You know, in his group, these are good guys, right? Right. You know, these are his friends. These are the people that he's going to go through his time served with them. I mean, I already said earlier in this podcast, 19 years have gone by and this group is still together. What does that tell me about the people that he's with? They did a heinous thing.
Oh, yeah.
They must have did something really, really bad to be there 19 years. And they were a group way before Andy probably showed up, because they were all connected in some type of way.
Yeah, it seems that way.
Yeah, especially when they're playing the game about which new guy is going to freak out first, right? It makes you, wonder about, what these guys did. I mean, you got Haywood, who's the one that Brooks, has that knife to his neck and mm-hmm. stuff. He kind of plays the blumbling idiot, even though he picks the right guy. And he kind of eggs him on and get him basically killed, even though he doesn't want him to be killed.
But he feels guilty about it, yeah.
He does feel guilty. And that's the other thing about some of these side characters, is there's some that are played very one-dimensional. But Haywood is one of those where, at the end of the day, even though he is a little bit of an idiot to a certain extent, he says things like dumbass as the name of
instead author. Of Alexander Dumas, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's weird things about him, but there are some redeeming things too. Like, he's one of the first people that wants, when he gets out of the hole, to do something nice for Andy when he gets out. They're bonded, but I think it's the right thing for...
And he likes Hank Williams.
And he likes Hank Williams. Yeah, he's a little disappointed that he didn't play Hank Williams over the air. You play this opera stuff. Who wants to listen to that? But everybody did.
I'll tell you something about that, though, too.
Ted, did you like the book better than the movie, or vice versa?
They're just different enough that I like them both equally.
Really?
And okay. I'll tell you my opinion, and when we do our final review, exactly how I feel between the two.
So I won't even read the book because of how much I enjoyed this movie.
I highly recommend reading different seasons. King does books of short stories. These are novellas. They're like 150 to 200 pages, so they're not like a full novel. Like, Apt Pupil is so much better than the movie. The movie should be burned. It's so much better. And I love Ian McKellen in the movie. It's so much better. So much more evil. And The Body is even so much different than Stand By Me. But yeah, I highly recommend it. Well, I highly recommend any Stephen King book.
My understanding is Stephen King does better short story books than his long stories, because the funny thing is that he has a problem with finishing longer stories.
I was just going to say that. Endings are not always King's strong suit, but his short stories can be a lot scarier. Like, the movie 1408 is based off of a short story. I think it's like an hour, 45-minute movie. Is literally only like 10 pages long.
Really? But only 10 pages?
The short story is, wow. And of course, Children of the Corn. Children of the Corn, I think, is maybe 25 pages.
It's crazy.
And they turned it into how many movies? The first one good, but the rest of them bad.
Though I don't mind the third one too much. I had mentioned earlier about Tim Robbins and his facial expressions and how he doesn't really have like big smiles. But there's one exception to that rule, is when he's explaining to Red about how he's in this money laundering type of situation with the warden. And he's got this alias called Randall Stevens. Mm-hmm. But he's so proud that he has made this guy up out of thin air by just filling out forms. He actually has a huge smile on his face. It's like one of the greatest accomplishments is to create a person out of thin air. One of the best things in the movie is that section where Red calls him like a Picasso or something, like, something to that nature, because of how smart Andy, as you stated earlier, he's a genius, and how he figured to make this up. That's one of my favorite parts in the whole movie.
I agree. It also has one of my favorite lines, where Tim Robbins is looking through the stacks at Morgan Freeman. He goes, "Red, I thought you thought I was better than that." It's like that I was smarter than that. I like that. The other part where he has a big smile on his face, and I want to get to it. It's when he does lock the door and turn on the opera. He's playing The Marriage of Figaro. And Red, in his narration, talks about an act of defiance. The Marriage of Figaro itself was an act of defiance, that opera. And he created it anyway. It's a masterpiece. The fact that Darabont chose that particular piece, to me, he's never said it, but to me, it signifies Andy knew what he was doing. And to me, that, okay, you want defiance? I'll show you defiance. I'm not only going to play music over there, I'm going to play something that itself an act of defiance. Because Mozart defied the king. He defied the king of Austria, who declared that they should never make anything out of the book, The Marriage of Figaro, let alone an opera. I love that. And I love the fact that everybody stops, because it's something so foreign that they're actually getting a piece of the outside. The aria is so beautiful. To me, it's one of those perfect scenes, too. And Andy knows he's going to get in trouble. And it's kind of funny because the guard that he locks in the bathroom is kind of friendly to him.
Right, he's nice.
Kind of friendly to Andy. Because not all of the guards are assholes. And of course, he's reading Archie, an Archie comic, which is kind of another
thing. Why wouldn't he be?
Exactly. Just to kind of play off the fact that Andy's up here and everybody else is below.
The simplicity of Archie.
Exactly. Red's narration over it is really good. He goes, I don't know what those two Italian ladies were singing about, but it's magical.
Well, it's very layered as you're putting it. I mean, he's playing, like you said, a song about defiance, and you know he purposely picked that out to stick it to them.
Right.
You know, it wasn't just to listen to a song, even though he says music, you know, once you hear something, they can't take that away from you. But I think the selection of choice here is what really matters, like you said. But the problem is the warden and the others don't know why he's picked this song. That's what makes his character so layered. It doesn't come across being like he's, I don't know how to put it. He's not an arrogant guy throughout the whole movie. But from time to time, he shows people how smarter he is than everybody else, but it's not like so thrown right into your face. You don't get it till later on that, holy crap, this guy is one of the smartest people you could ever meet.
He's been playing the system for decades. Get where he is. Ken, let's talk about part two of Shawshank Redemption.
In 1965, Andy and Red befriend Tommy Williams, a young prisoner incarcerated for burglary. A year later, Andy helps him pass the GED exam. Tommy reveals to Red and Andy that his cellmate at another prison had claimed responsibility for the murders of which Andy was convicted of. Andy brings the information to Norton, who refuses to listen. He's obtuse. When Andy mentions the money laundering, Norton sends Andy to confinement and has Hadley Failey shoot Tommy under the guise of an escape attempt, even though there were other prisoners in that hallway that basically saw him go out to meet the warden. After Andy refuses to continue the money laundering, Lorton threatens to destroy the library, remove Andy's protection from the guards, and move him to worse conditions. Andy's released from confinement after 2 months and tells a skeptical Red that he dreams of living in a Mexican town on the Pacific coast. He asks Red to promise, once he is released, to travel to a specific hayfield near Buxton and recover a package that Andy buried there. Red worries about Andy's mental well-being, especially when he learns Andy asked a fellow inmate for a rope. At the next day roll call, the guards find Andy's cell empty. An irate Norton throws a rock at a poster of Raquel Welch hanging on the cell wall, revealing a tunnel that Andy had dug with his rock hammer. The previous night, Andy had used a rope to escape through the tunnel and prison sewage pipe, taking Norton's suit, shoes, and ledger containing evidence of the money laundering and corruption at Shawshank. While guards search for him, Andy poses as Randall Stevens and withdraws over $370,000 of laundered money from several banks, and mails the ledger to a local newspaper. State police arrive at Shawshank and take Hadley into custody while Norton commits suicide to avoid arrest. The following year, Red is paroled after serving 40 years but struggles to adapt to life outside of prison Remembering his promise to Andy, he visits Buxton and finds a letter asking him to come to that Mexican town. Red violates the parole by traveling to Fort Hancock, Texas, and crossing the border into Mexico, admitting that he finally feels hope. He finds Andy standing an old boat on the beach, and the two reunited friends happily embrace. And that's the end of the Shawshank Redemption.
And what a great ending it is. The build-up of part two is incredible.
That ending wasn't going to be that way. And the director did not want to have a kind of like embrace. You notice the last few minutes of, there's no dialogue. Red's narration about leaving, violating his parole, is basically the last thing we hear, because the director didn't even want them to even meet up at the beach.
He wanted it to end like the novella, where it's more obscure as to whether or not Red finds him. A couple of differences here in the second half from the book that's noticeable is Tommy doesn't get killed in the book. He just gets transferred away so he can't testify. Yeah, the end is quite different, more obscure. And Darabont wanted it to end that way. I'm kind of glad that they chose not to. Because the ending, I think, is perfect here for the movie.
Yeah, it's perfect with no dialogue. You don't need a dialogue. Yeah. You just need to smile from a distance from both of them. And then we see, like, the parting shot from up above of them hugging. That's even done the right way. I think choosing these differences over what's in the book are so important, especially with Tommy getting killed. I think you needed a little bit more for the warden to be that evil. I think it works in the book, as you've been saying to us, because you have three different wardens.
Right.
So with three different wardens, it makes sense maybe to just transfer them. But with the one evil warden throughout the whole movie, to try to be kind of consistent and make him the ultimate bad guy here, I think killing Tommy is the right thing to do.
Yeah, you kind of understand that the warden doesn't view these guys as humans, but you just don't know how disposable he looks at human life. It's at that point you realize just how disposable he thinks humans are. It's really gross and really just downright evil. And it's never said why Hadley gets arrested, but it's my belief that Hadley gets charged with murder.
I think so.
That's how I look at it.
Not just him. There's probably other instances at the beginning of the movie where he kills the one inmate.
That actually makes even more sense than Tommy, because Andy asks what that inmate's name was at the chow table that first day.
Who cares what his name is?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, Andy does. Maybe it's for that particular
person. He's keeping track of things, right?
Paper trail,
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I do love Bob Gunton, the guy who plays the warden, his performance. The performances from everybody that's in the cell after Andy's disappeared is so great, because Morgan Freeman has this just complete, like, innocent, like, childish, like, look on his face.
Yeah.
And
he has no idea. He's not in on it.
And Hadley's just kind of beside himself, doesn't know what to do, because he knows the warden's probably going to blame him. And then the warden is just, he doesn't know what to say or do. And he calls Raquel Welch Fuzzy Britches. It makes me laugh, because I love watching all of the different characters that are there, just how they're trying to come to terms with what's going on.
You mentioned that part with the warden, but my favorite part with the warden is when he goes to confinement to check on Andy and lets him know about...
That's evil too, man.
Yeah, it's so evil, but he just goes, tells him about the kid that died, but then at the end he says, or am I being obtuse? It throws it back at him. Mm-hmm. Again, he thinks he's in control of this. It's like you said, it's a chess game. This is the warden's move. But it's my favorite part of him in the movie, because I feel like it's not the killing of Tommy's that's the most evil. It's what he does afterwards. Throwing it into Andy's face, saying, look what I can do. You're nothing.
Yeah. And keeping him in the hole for another month.
Right.
Yeah, just to think about it.
Yeah. And the big guy that's part of Floyd, I think is his name, says that he had never heard of anybody serving a month in solitary before in the hole. and Andy's put in for 2 months. And you can tell it had an effect on Andy, that Andy was done at that point. Andy knows that the warden killed Tommy. Yeah, it's so sad because the one guard does tell Andy that, you know, that Tommy passed the exams with a C+. Yeah, it's, and Tommy's death is horrible.
They
it's
build just, that up like, you know, you're building Tommy's character. Here's a guy who's all this great information for Andy that, you know, maybe he can get free. He's passing his GED. He has a wife and child at home. All this stuff. You're having all these good vibes about Tommy. And to see Tommy get executed the way he did brings you back to reality. And I think that's what this movie does a great job of, is when hope is built up, it comes crashing back down. It makes you realize how still awful a place this is, because you see at times like the library. The library is being built up. Well, we could tear the library all the way down. Brooks is going to be released. Hey, good, you know, awesome. But then, you know, Brooks kills himself because he can't handle it on the other side. There's all these good moments where you're like, you're cheering for these inmates, even though we don't know what any of these guys have done. And again, that's great choice of not telling us. I think we get conflicted if we know too much about each of these characters, except for Andy.
Well, everybody's innocent in Shawshank.
Exactly. And I think they do that. And that's true probably of real life events like that. But I think they purposely reiterate that throughout the whole movie to allow you to like these characters.
Yeah. Eric, that's where you're supposed to pipe in and say, lawyer, fuck me.
Nice. Lawyer, fuck
me. I think that's what they really did say, is like, maybe the lawyer really did fuck him. So, I mean, if you think about it, when with Andy, yes, he had the gunshells and the bottles there and everything. Wasn't that place robbed?
I mean, he was set up. Well, he was clearly set up.
But that wasn't brought up in the trial that there was a robbery, too.
We only get a brief snippet of what went on in the trial. But one of the side views of Andy's lawyer, I think, is when the DA is giving his summation, his lawyer almost kind of nods along with the DA. It's like, oh, yeah, Andy's screwed.
Yeah, it's a big setup.
But going back to this part here where we're getting towards the end, I love the fact that we do not know as first-time watchers what's going on with Andy when he gets out of confinement. And him and Red are talking, and they go back and forth, you know, with the line, get busy living, get busy dying.
Right.
And you got the rope and everything like that. And it makes you question, first-time watch, what Andy is really going to do. Because we really don't know if he's planning a breakout. We don't know. Maybe he is. Maybe he's going to try to break out. But we've already seen Brooks commit suicide. And you got the rope there. The director and the screenplay are doing a great job here of setting us up to doubt what's going to happen to Andy, the guy who's the biggest optimist in all of Shawshank. But as Red says, everybody has a breaking point. And has he hit his breaking point? And the answer is yes. He's hit his breaking point, but it's the breaking point of get busy living. I got to try this now. There's not anything more I can do here. You know, he's very proud of the fact that he's got a library and he's gotten people their GEDs and stuff. He feels like he's paid his price. Even though he didn't commit these murders, he felt he was guilty of his wife's murder to a certain extent. So I think he did this purposely. I think he served these full 19 years because that's what he thought he deserved.
Yeah. A lot of what you're saying, too, is also conveyed in the imagery after he escapes. And it's the picture of Tim Robbins with his arms outstretched with the water, essentially baptizing him, washing away all of the filth, we know, because he crawled through 500 yards of shit.
Which is also empty, by the way?
Well, it all spewed out. It all spewed out.
All of it, though? I mean, it probably should all spewed out.
Of it. Yeah, most of it did. But even that's symbolic. The statement, he crawled through 500 yards of shit to get free. You could look at that as the time frame that it took 500 yards worth of shit. He took 19 years to get himself free. But it's the imagery of the washing away of the sins that felt that he had committed. And it's just, to me, it's very symbolic. In my opinion, there's a couple of indelible images where you're talking about where Tim Robbins is sitting on the ground and Morgan Freeman's kind of not sitting, but he's like on his the balls of his feet, knelt down next to him. That's an image that is indelible. But the image of Tim Robbins in the river with his arms outstretched, just having everything washed away from him. It's, to me, it's very heavy. It's great. I like that. It's
fun
amazing.
Fact about Tim Robbins. He is a very tall guy. I believe he's 6'4", 6'5".
Right. Yeah.
And you notice that in the lineup at the beginning of the movie, how tall he is between other people. But throughout the rest of the movie, they always have him slouching or crunched over, never side by side. You know, they're watching the movie, he's coming over and he's crunched over. They played this to kind of make sure that people didn't really look at his height over Red and everybody else. I always thought that was kind of interesting since of how tall he was.
He's floating under the radar.
Right. And then we get to find out the reason why he takes those strolls is to release those rocks and things of that nature. I do have some problems with this escape a little bit, but they're just being nitpicky. How does he get the poster back where it is? Because they have to tear through that poster. It wasn't like it was like hanging there. So the poster.
Well, they showed
they ripped right through and pulled it out, but he had to sneak in and. I mean, that one's probably okay, but where did he find the big-ass rock to break through it? Did he know that there was going to be this huge thunderstorm? And then when did he figure out that when the right timing is?
Yeah, didn't the storm start when he was in the office with the warden or when he was shining
in the warden's
shoes?
I don't know if it was or not. I just know. I mean, you know, thunderstorms, it's hard to predict how long a thunderstorm will be, even if you even heard that there's going to be one. So that one is a little difficult for me to swallow a little bit. But again, it's just being nitpicky. I mean, it's a great escape, but at the same time, you know, you could poke little holes in it here and there as far as the probability that all works out, right? And crawling through that sewer, I kind of disagree with you. Even though he hit that pipe and shit spilled out all over the place, I don't think that would make the whole thing, basically.
Well, it wasn't completely empty.
Not completely, I mean, but it was. It was just kind of like the bottom of it was there's stuff there. Yeah. It wasn't. You would think he would have to kind of almost like swim through it to a certain extent. Or there would have to be shit that would be continuously coming through. That's how I look at it. But like I said, it's being nitpicky. And now,
this concludes Shit Talk with Ken.
And that's right.
It makes you want to go back and watch this movie from the beginning just to see where Andy started plotting. And through this podcast, we've concluded that he probably started as soon as he probably said, what was the name of the guy that got killed by the guard? And his wheels are always turning. Yeah, and it took maybe a month or two for him to figure out who he could talk to, who's the right guy to kind of help him through this. Like Red and his group. You know, Red has connections. Red is the most likely going to be the kind of guy that's going to get me on certain work details that maybe will help me. It's those type of rewatches that you have to do over and over again. This is one of the most rewatchable movies of all time. You know, you said you watched this on like TBS or TNT. I don't know of a time where I was passing through channels and I saw it that I didn't stop and watch it for a little bit.
And that's why it's become a verb. It's called being Shawshanked, where you're flipping through channels and a movie comes on and you have to stop and watch it. That phenomenon is called being Shawshanked.
Kind of like being Munsoned.
The ending is kind of a surprise. For it to be rewatchable is in itself amazing.
Totally agree with that. Yeah.
Those are the great movies when you've seen it 1,000 times. You know how it's going to end. You can play out every line, but you're still drawn to watching it when it's on. Whether it's 5 minutes in or 10 minutes, everything comes to a stop. You just sit down and you're just like engulfed in it.
I think it's because Andy is sticking it to the man. And you just love rewatching Andy sticking it to, like he's wearing, you know, the warden's shoes back to the cell. He's, you know, stealing his clothes. He's taking the ledgers. He's mailing. He's doing all these things. And it's not just this ending part. He's doing this throughout the whole movie. You kind of appreciate it, the character of Andy. And as much as I love Morgan Freeman in this movie, because, I mean, anytime Morgan Freeman can narrate your movie, You have him narrate your movie. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
He's the voice of God.
Yeah. Literally, yes, exactly.
When I get to heaven, I hope the voice of God is Morgan Freeman.
If I die and somebody can narrate my life story, that would be Morgan Freeman. Try to figure out how you're going to make that work, guys, if he's still around.
We'll work on that for you.
We'll work on that. Our people will contact his people.
But Morgan Freeman is awesome in here, but the character of Andy is written amazingly. He's got to be top five best written characters ever.
I can't disagree.
Something tells me we're going to give this movie some pretty good reviews.
I find myself, no matter how many times I've watched it, that even when it gets to the point where, and I know how Andy escapes, I still want to see it. I'm like, because I can't believe it that he does it. It's one of those weird, but also too, we talk about hope and everything and how wonderful Andy is. This is a beautiful love story between two friends. And I think that we can't lose that aspect of it either. The friendship between Red and Andy, essentially, while Red saves Andy at the beginning, Andy saves Red too. And both Morgan Freeman and Tim Robbins talk about that when you hear them discuss the movie. It's such a beautiful love story between two best friends. And I really like that aspect of it too.
So I would say Andy does risk Red getting into trouble when he tunnels out. I mean, true. If the cops don't come sooner, who does the warden take it out on?
And right, exactly.
I would think it's got to be Red, and he's got to think Red's got to know something. He says that they're like thick as thieves, these two.
Right.
So what Andy knows, Red's got to know, right? You know, you say that Red has that dumb look on his face, but the warden probably isn't buying that. And if I think more time is allowed, there could be problems for Red. I don't know if Andy realizes that, because also the guard that you said he locked in the bathroom, we don't know what happens to him afterwards.
I'm assuming he gets fired.
Does he get fired?
Yeah.
Right. And he was nice to Andy. Yeah.
Right. So
Andy almost, to a certain extent, cares about Andy, because this whole plan is about Andy. And he hopes that Red's going to be part of it. I know he hopes that Red's going to be part of it, but let's be honest. You've noticed this is a great friendship. At the end of the day, Andy's thinking about Andy, right?
Kind of have to. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, but I still think that, yeah, I mean, the warden could have had Hadley beat up Red.
It would have been consistent.
I think at that point, they're all so exasperated and shocked by the fact that Andy was able to pull this off. I think that just kind of, it puts everybody on tilt and distracts them. And I think that,
especially with a little rock hammer over decades.
Yeah, exactly. I think that Red's actually pretty safe, because it's like, these guys have no idea.
The warden knows that he has been played for two decades. Yeah.
He doesn't want to expose anything else.
Right.
He's safe at that moment. He's safe for the moment, because all they're concerned about is finding Andy. But they're going to figure out, because the warden knows and other people know, that Red is the guy who could get things. They probably would say that hammer came from Red. Just putting it out there. But it doesn't play out that way, because how quick the timetable is, you know, within a couple
days.
But
he's had that hammer for 19 years. I mean,
but who still would have? Who would have still? So how would he have gotten the hammer in the first place? And
but no one thinks that a little rock hammer like that's going to do any harm to anything. That's the whole point of it.
It wasn't that little at the beginning of the movie, to be honest with you. If you look at the Bible, and it's fun that it's the beginning of the book is Exodus. So that's a lot of fun that starts right there. Those little things, right? But, I mean, if you saw the size of the cutout in the Bible itself, that's a big hammer. And it's kind of surprising that when the warden held it in his hand, that he didn't feel the weight of the hammer.
Yeah, I think Andy knew how much it all weighed.
Oh, he probably measured it.
Sure.
Yeah. It's wonder how he got that all digged out of the Bible for it to fit just exactly like that. But, I that's just nitpicking here and there about it.
Hey, man, he had 19 years to do it.
I love the inscription in the Bible as well. Salvation lies within, warden.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just it a is. Middle finger to him. It's
Should we
so
go
great.
Into our reviews here?
Yes, let's go ahead and do so.
All right, I'll kick this one off here. So my reviewer that I am lying myself, it's a pretty simple review actually, from Yardina Arar of the Los Angeles Daily News. Yardina says, it's Robbins and Freeman who carry the film. working around the most predictable moments with simple understatement. And I think that really sets this movie off. There's no overacting in this movie. This movie is simple understatement. It is simple acting. It plays so well to the audience. It plays so well to the fellow actors in the movie. It's a perfect film. It flows beautifully. This is one of my favorites of all time. We all agree that if we see this thing on, we're going to sit down, put blinders on, and watch this movie. It's a classic. It's a top 100 of all time for AFI, and it's probably a top 10 for me, if not top 15. Five hooks for me on this one, Shawshank Redemption. How about you, Ken?
I'm going to go with Helen Thompson of The Age, and she put down that both a classic prison film and a superior movie, the acting is flawless, the script is engrossing, and the direction is strong. All that is true. In fact, I couldn't find a review that like hit everything that I wanted to hit.
Man, you should have read that as Yoda.
It does sound a little Yodish.
Yes.
This movie for me is really, it's one of the best movies I've seen in my lifetime. The performances are perfect. The screenwriting is amazing. There are some cliches here and there, but they're overlooked by how it's presented. The only knock I have on this movie is the length. It could have been trimmed down a tad here and there.
What is this, 220? It's not terribly long.
Okay.
It just feels like it, right?
It feels a tad long. It could be slow at times, but the payoff is worth it. So if you can stick out some of the times where it may drag a little bit, but it's also prison. You know, we're talking about time. As Ted stated earlier, time kind of like ceased to exist in prison.
Yeah. And we're talking about weightlifting and sexual assaults and food eating.
Yeah, I saw no weightlifting in this movie, so I don't know. But I'm going to go ahead and give it 4.5 hooks. I would give it 5, but it's not one of those that it's not my top tier movie where I see it every single chance I can get. But like I said earlier, it's one of those movies when it's on, I'll catch it for a little bit because I know every nook and cranny in this movie. I've seen it from beginning to the end so many times. It might be in my top 10 of movies that I have started and finished without stopping. Is this one of those movies that just holds your attention? So yes, 4.5 hooks.
All right, Ted, what do you got?
Well, I'm going to put myself here with Peter Travers from Rolling Stone. He concludes his review with Robbins and Freeman connect with the bruised souls of Andy and Red to create something undeniably powerful and moving. I couldn't agree more. I kind of teased a little bit of something. It's my opinion, as far as a book-to-screen movie, this is one of the best ever made. This is no doubt the finest Stephen King adaptation from book to movie. I don't count The Shining because The Shining, the movie, and The Shining, the book, are two completely different entities, and it was designed that way. This is a masterpiece, and now that I know that it went up against Forrest Gump, this is so much better than Forrest Gump. That's a crime.
Okay, Forrest Gump is a 5 hook for me, too, just to put that out there.
So. I mean, yeah, Forrest Gump's really good. It makes me cry at the end. It is what it is. But
it's not an Oscar movie.
As far as a movie goes, as far as what makes me love movies, this is what makes me love movies. The cinematography is brilliant. To hear people talk about the screenplay, and not people that were just in the movie, the fact that they consider the screenplay, the original screenplay, to be a masterpiece. It's amazing. I mean, you just don't get that. These characters are timeless. Andy Dufresne, to me, is as timeless as George Bailey is in It's a Wonderful Life. That's the level that I think we're talking about. Dorothy from Wizard of Oz. He's an indelible character that is just unforgettable. It makes me happy. Because it's so sad at parts, but the end makes me so filled with joy and happiness that it's infectious. And seeing the look on my daughter's face when we finished the movie and how happy it made her when she saw the ending and was like so on the edge of her seat, literally not knowing whether or not Andy had killed himself. That's what movies are supposed to be. You know, it's a connection, and it's a connection that, you know, the friendship aspect, I don't want to lose sight of that. It's how I feel about you guys. And it's a connection. It's a personal thing.
I'm not going to Mexico with you, Ted. Sorry to tell you.
No, I'm not asking you to. San Juan Tenejo.
I'd even say that word because it was such a long name. I decided to say a town in Mexico. That's what I said.
Town in Mexico. No, it's fine. No, it just hits every note. This, if we could go above a five hook, I would. This is completely five hooks.
Is this a top five? Top three?
When it comes to top 10 movies for me, it's almost like they're all interchangeable. But this is definitely, it's close to a top 10 movie for me. I own it on every single format.
Do you have Laserdisc?
I don't have Laserdisc. I don't know what's a Laserdisc.
You don't have every format, do you?
Maybe I should look into that.
Maybe, but I have it on Laserdisc. I don't know.
Oh, do you?
I might. I don't know.
He has a lot of Laserdisc.
Got way too many Laserdiscs. Mm-hmm.
Again, I don't know. I don't know how this movie didn't win Best Adapted Screenplay. I mean,
yeah, that's true.
How Forrest ridiculous. Gump won it? I'm sorry, yeah, Eric, no, but Forrest
no,
Gump
for I, adapted, I, screenplay? Adapted screenplay. I give yes.
I know you love the movie. Have you ever read the book?
No, I have not.
The book is definitively horrible.
Oh, Forrest Gump.
Yes.
Okay.
And the second one is completely unreadable. But anyway, yes, I completely agree with you, Ken. The fact that this screenplay, the way everybody talks about this screenplay, didn't win Best Adapted Screenplay, it's a crime.
But, of course, Gump shouldn't have been even nominated. I'm sorry to say, but I don't think it should even have been nominated for that.
Well, that's
an Academy Award, but nah, not for a screenplay.
We'll debate that when we do Forrest Gump. As far as the Shawshank goes, yeah, this movie's, it's a masterpiece. How many movies can you say have crossed over from being a noun to a verb? I
Kingpin.
Absolutely adore this movie. Yeah, yes, exactly. There you go.
Great. All right. Well, we all give it a 4.5 to 5 hooks to 5+ hooks is what Ted will give it. How ironic, I'm pulling it audible. Our next movie is going to be Forrest Gump. Yay!
Oh, hey, what do you know? What do you know?
Just kidding, I'm not pulling it audible. Ken would have my head. So we're going to go in a different direction, though. We're going to go comedy, one of the greatest comedies, I think, of all time, and has a lot to talk about. 1984 kicked off sequels, kicked off other versions of this movie, but the original is still the best.
Hold on. Who are you going to call?
That's right. Who are you going to call? That should give it away right now, everybody. Who are you going to call?
Ghostbusters.
That's right. Biggest hit for Ray Parker Jr. One of the biggest
movies.
Wow, yeah. Only hit for Ray Parker Jr.
Yes. He did some stuff with radio, his band. But yes, for his solos. No, he had a few other hits, believe it or not.
Did
but,
he? Okay.
The Other Woman comes to mind. That was one of
his
big hits.
We'll take your word for it.
But yeah. It wasn't Ghostbusters. This song was I remember,
the
man,
video.
I remember this. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. 1984.
I wore the soundtrack out.
You couldn't go anywhere in 1984 without this movie being anywhere in the lexicon of life. So we are going to talk about it. And why are we talking about it, Ken? What's the significance?
Well, one of our listeners, first of all, Chris Ostrowski, asked us to review the film. But I chose to do it during this time of the month because Ghostbusters sequel is coming out in March. So we figured instead of around Halloween, we decided to do it around this time to celebrate the new sequel coming out.
And jump on the Ghostbusters bandwagon.
We're gonna do the ladies Ghostbusters eventually.
Oh, no, we're not.
Not the bandwagon. We're jumping on the Ecto-1.
Dude, we're jumping on the Ecto-1 of talk. That's right.
Don't cross
All
the
right,
screens.
So tell us where they can find us on the World Wide Web, Ted.
We can be found on Twitter at HookedOn_movies. And whatever podcast version you're listening to us on, whether it be Good Pods, Apple, Spotify, you name it, we're probably there.
Better
leave
be.
Us a yeah, exactly. Leave us a 5-star review. Tell us what you think of Shawshank. Write us something nice. Tell us what you think about the other reviews that we've done. It just helps us get noticed.
Great. Ken, Facebook, a lot of cool stuff going on there.
Yes, join us on our Facebook page, Hooked on Movies. We play trailers, we play scenes for movies, we talk about movies, we talk about actors, we talk about people that were actors that died. I hate to say that, but that's kind of a common thing that we do there. You can also, if you don't want to go go on the Twitter, or if you don't want to, go on the Facebook page and you want to do old school email, you can email us at hookedonmovies13@gmail.com.
Whoa, we got a Gmail account now. How about that? Sweet.
Look okay. at us. I thought we would have a Hotmail account.
Yeah, well.
We could have Hotmail too, have all Yahoo, the whole gambit.
MySpace,
absolutely. We'll go retro for that 4 or 5 MySpace people left. All right. Well, I'm going to change my lineup. I'm going to go in lieu of Ghostbusters here. I'm going to change my line to I blame myself for this podcast.
See you at the movies.
See you next time on Hooked on Movies.